Hello, and welcome to episode 13 of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. My name is Steve Van Der Ark, and I am the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website. And before we go diving into Book 6, which is our topic for this particular episode, I have a couple of things to talk about. First of all, this is being recorded on July 7, 2012, and on Pottermore, Slytherin has just won the House Cup. And I say that only because, number one, I'm not a Slytherin, so I'm a little bit disgruntled, but also, they are going to get early access to the new chapters for Chamber of Secrets, which is, of course, my point, is the new chapters are coming along. Chamber of Secrets is going to be added. I don't know if it's going to be the entire book or some chapters of it, and we don't know exactly when, but definitely excited about this development on Pottermore and the fact that we are going to be able to start delving into a new book over there. Aside from that, one other thing I really want to talk about is the fact that the Harry Potter Lexicon website, the book version, the print version, is now available as an ebook. And I just have to tell you a little background on that book because some people are curious about that. I think that really the idea for this book started back in about 2003 or 2004, already at the first conventions. The first Harry Potter convention was in 2003, which was Nimbus, which was in Orlando. And I remember at that already, it was kind of a surprise and a shock even to realize how many people were excited about the Harry Potter Lexicon website at that point and wanted more information. They wanted to talk to me about it. And one thing they really wanted to get from me was a print version of the website. Because Harry Potter fans then and now are book fans. I mean, I just read Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, for example. And I mean, the whole thing, I'm holding this lovely, chunky book. I was actually reading the British edition. And to me, that's reading the books, is holding that in my hand. And people wanted to have the lexicon as a reference while they read the books, but they wanted it as a book. Now, of course, back in 2003, there were not e-books in the sense that there are today. But really, that was the genesis of the Harry Potter Lexicon book, which has, over the years, did quite a bit of evolving and changing into what it actually became. Originally, the Lexicon book was going to be the website as a print, you know, a print version of the website, which is exactly what had been the plan all along. And through the course of a lot of events, which I guess many of you are aware of, the book evolved and changed to become something which would be more more acceptable to Rowling and to Warner Brothers. And as a result, what we have in the Lexicon book is this wonderful quick reference. It's not just the website copied over, because now in retrospect, I think, you know, if people wanted the website, they'd go to the website. They don't need to buy a book for that. But what it is an A to Z, but also it gives a lot of background that's not on the website. A lot of its material, which is not really available anywhere except for in this book, and that's the book that came out a couple of years ago, 2009. And now that I've finally gotten around to doing all the work that was required, I've converted it over to an ebook, and that book is now available to use. And what's so great about it in ebook form is that even if you're reading the books, you can do a quick lookup. You can quick find out, who is this person? How does this connect? What's the background on that name and things like this? Well, that book became available about a week and a half ago or so. It became available on Kindle and on Nook. And I'm excited about that. It's very fun. I mean, what happened in the last couple of years is that the requests have all been for the Lexicon to be available as an ebook, and so it is now. So check out if you're looking for links, you can go to the show notes as usual on the Lexicon website, and the show notes will give you information about how to get a hold of those. And so I'm excited about finally that book becoming part of the Harry Potter Lexicon Reader's Guide series. The Reader's Guide to Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone was the first book in that series, so that's the second. Third book is the Reader's Guide to Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, and I've been working on that constantly this summer. Hopefully get that out in the next month or so. So then there'll be three, and then I'm also starting to put plans together for the fourth volume in that series. So Moving on from that, you know, as part of, I said we're talking about book six today and talking about that book and how it fits into the whole saga, which, of course, is what we've been doing. And one of the things that I do when I look at this is I go back to sources, interviews and things like this. And I went back to, well, first of all, I was going to go back to the interviews that Rowling did after Book 6 came out and before Book 7, just to kind of remember our frame of mind as fans between those two books. And also between Book 5 and Book 6, because so much had changed. And we talked about that over the last two episodes, about how much changed in the world of Harry Potter fandom, and in the world of Harry Potter itself, in the universe of Harry Potter, with the release of Book 5, and what a dramatic turn the story took. And now as we're looking at the whole saga, and I want to talk about Book 6, and we will in a moment, but I wanted to go back and I wanted to look at some of these sources. But it's interesting, I also discovered, this is a source which comes from, actually from 2000, and this is something which I was a little surprised, because this is not something that I had seen before, and even though it's, you know, a very old source, I guess, and this is something which just kind of is worth looking at when we talk about these sources, and also about the Lexicon book and its, you know, where did things come from? Where did Rowling get her inspiration for things? This is just a good example of how muddy that water can be, how difficult it can be to actually tease out how Rowling came up with things. This is actually a source which has to do with the name Hogwarts. What happened was Rowling actually said, she was asked where the word Hogwarts came from, and she actually said, you know, well, this is where I got that. And what she said is that she borrowed the name, and I'm now reading from the Lexicon book. According to J.K. Rowling, she borrowed the name for the school from a variety of flower she saw in Kew Gardens. She then decided, by way of explanation within the story, that Rowena Ravenclaw dreamed of a warty hog leading her to the place near the lake where Hogwarts was eventually founded. That's the information we have, or had. This is a reference back from 2000, which I was not even aware of. It actually comes from The Independent. And what it is this is from September 22, 2000. This is a reference that somebody came up with. I'm going to read a little bit from what this article says. Hogwarts, it turns out, features in one of the classic 1950s Molesworth books, written by Geoffrey Willens and illustrated by Ronald Searle. The connection between Harry Potter and Molesworth had been discovered by Oxford Classics professor Richard Jenkins, whose literary scoop appears in this month's issue of the intellectual magazine Prospect. Now, notice, this is from 2000, and maybe other people had noticed it, but I had not seen this before. But this is a connection from these 1950s, what they call the Molesworth books, which were of the genre of the schoolboy fiction. This is a lot more of a parody, a lot more of a kind of a folk, a funny, jokey kind of a story. But these books had, and I'm going to read a little more here, in the Molesworth book, How to Be Top, says Jenkins, there is a cod Latin play, The Hogwarts, by Marcus Plautus Molesworthus, which is, of course, a made-up name worthy of Rowling. And Hogwart, with two G's, is also the name given to the headmaster of Porridge Court, a rival academy. So the word Hogwarts appeared in this book back in the 50s. Now, the point that we kind of have to take from this is that we can say, did Rowling use that because of the reference in the Molesworth books? Well, the fact of the matter is, we have no idea. We don't know if she ever read those books. As not being a British, having grown up in British society, I don't know how well known those books are, whether that would be something that many people would just know, even if they hadn't read the books. She said that she got the name from this plant that she saw in Kew Gardens. The fact of the matter is, we just don't know. Did she see that word Hogwarts at some point in the Molesworth books, but never really think about it, and then saw the flower and then kind of borrowed it And then in her mind, that's where it came from, even though she'd seen it. We basically have no way to know. That just demonstrates just how difficult it is to tease out where things come from. Unless she specifically says, but even if she does, it's impossible to be absolutely sure. And so in things like the Lexicon book, where we put a lot of references, some things are obvious. Centaurs come from mythology. We know that. It's very clear that she, as she said, modified what you find in folklore and legend and mythology and so to fit her story. She said very clearly that she does that. But were there other connections? For example, this is one that always struck me. Near where she went to university in Exeter, there's a town called Quoditch. 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 Now, did she get the word Quidditch from Quoditch? She says no. She thought it up. But what informed her thinking as she was trying to come up with the word that started with Q to be the name of her sport? Somewhere in, she must have seen this town name, or it seems very logical that she would have seen it, since that area of in the West Country is not that large. And so, can you say that she got the name from there? No, she thought it up all of her, without that as a direct reference. But did that inform her thinking, without her maybe even realizing it? And then is the same possibly true of the word Hogwarts? The fact of the matter is, it's great fun to try to tease these things out, to try to work these things out, but anyone who says, well, this definitively is where it came from, you can't always say that. Even Rowling herself might not be aware of where some things came from, where some ideas got into her head. And I say that again because those who like to do what I do, which is to dig into the backgrounds and the lore of Harry Potter and the creation of this amazing fantasy world, this is a never-ending process, you might say. And there's always more to dig into and more to come up with and more to kind of figure out. And so, yes, we love to get Rowling's kind of definitive word in Pottermore. And you know, again, hopefully soon we'll get some more on the Chamber of Secrets front, and that'll happen soon. But even when we have that, even when we have Pottermore, there is still room for speculation, room for discussion, room for fans to think about and to talk about these books, which I think is one of the reasons that Rowling has been hesitant to release just every bit of information that she's ever scribbled down about her created world, because she knows, I think, that this is a dynamic place, this world of Harry Potter. I think authors quickly discover that they lose a little of the control they have over their world simply because once they've shared it, it becomes a shared place. And those of us that are staunch Harry Potter fans tend to get a little bit defensive, and they say, "Well, no, J.K. Rowling is the source, and she gets to say," and of course she does. But any author will tell you, once you release that creation to the world, the reader becomes part of the conversation, and true literature and true authors understand that the reader always becomes part of the conversation, and a good book is a conversation between the author and the reader, and it goes both ways. And it's interesting because as we talk about book six today, one of the things we need to be thinking about is how book six became or how the existence of fandom and of worldwide readership informed the creation of Book 6 and Book 7. But I think Book 6 in particular, because of the changes that happened in the series with Book 5, 6, 7, that little trilogy, if you will, this little section of three books, and how much changes happen in the writing, in the storytelling, but also in the saga itself, all of which, We can look at this and we can see that J.K. Rowling is very much in control of her story and always has been and continues to be and does not change her storytelling specifically because of fandom or because of the worldwide readership. But even if she does not, even if she stays true to her story, the fact that there is a worldwide readership has to, by the simple fact that she's writing in this new world of everybody knows Harry Potter and everybody's following exactly what she's doing, things have to change with her writing. But it is interesting. I was looking, I said I go back to sources and I read these things, and one of the sources that I was looking at was a chat that, or an interview that Rowling had with CBBC NewsRound, and this is from July 8, 2000. And one of the questions, and this just shows how much in control she is of her story, is the character of Rita the depiction of your relations with the press? Was the question she was asked. And this is her response. Well, I'll tell you the truth, but I doubt very much that anyone's going to want to hear this. I tried to put Rita first in Philosopher's Stone. When Harry walked into the Leaky Cauldron for the first time and everyone said, "Oh, Mr. Potter, you're back," I wanted to put a journalist in there. She wasn't called Rita then, though she was a woman. And then I thought, as I was sort of looking at the plot overall, and I thought, that's not really where she sits best. She sits best in 4, where he's supposed to come to terms with his fame. So I pulled Rita out of the book 1 and planned her entrance for book 4. And I was really looking forward to Rita coming in book 4. Now think about that. What she is, think about her now, as she's writing book 1. This is before there is a... this is before anything. This is just the planning phase. This is back in the early 1990s, before book 1 came out. She already had planned the character of similar to Rita Skeeter, maybe not by name, but that character. She already knew that book 4, Harry was going to come to terms with his fame. She already knew that this character fits the plot better here. Think about all that's implied in that statement. And once we understand that, and we start to look at the whole saga again, the way she was looking at it when she planned it, the whole story holds together so well because of that planning, because of that depth of understanding of her plot and her story and the saga. And again, why can we look at it now as we do in this holistic terms of this is the whole saga, this is the whole series of 7 books, this is how this book fits into that saga? The reason we do that, the reason this podcast does that, is because that's what she did. She looked at book 4 and said, Harry comes to terms with his fame. She looked at book 4, and as she said, it's the pivotal book. This is where things change. She looked at book 5 and saw things the way she did. Now we're talking about book 6, and we have to, again, we're going to be looking at book 6 as part of this whole saga. Before we do that, though, I do want to talk a little bit, and this is actually a throwback to book 5, and the reason I want to talk about this with regards to book 5 is because when they were making the film of Order of the Phoenix, I had the extraordinary opportunity to go and visit the sets while they were filming, which, you know, I realize that millions of people all over the world would kill for that opportunity, and I had that chance, which how can I ever express my gratefulness to Warner Brothers for allowing me to do that, to be on the set, to watch as they filmed, but I'll talk more about that, I think. As a matter of fact, we were on the set the day they were filming part of the final battle in the death chamber of the ministry, the Department of Mysteries, which is a funny thing because I was on my way to to Britain. I was actually in the airport, and I got a call from Warner Brothers, and they said, "We just want you to know that you are going to be watching the filming, and part of what you're seeing is the death of a major character, and we want to make sure that you understand that you are under a non-disclosure, and you can't talk about the death of that character." Now, you understand that this is during the filming of Order of the Phoenix, but this is after Book 6 already came out. not just book five, book six. I mean, everybody knew who died in book five. But still, I was bound by an NDA that I could not disclose who died in book five when talking about my visit to the set, which I think, you know, is kind of interesting. But what it shows you is that Warner Brothers was really sharing Rowling's deep desire that people don't get spoiled any more than absolutely necessary. Now, granted, the fact that they make films means that a whole bunch of people were spoiled before they ever got a chance to read the books. Can't get around that. I mean, either that or you don't make the films, okay? If you don't want people to be spoiled, you don't make the films till after the book comes out. But be that as it may, Rowling's desire is for people to experience the stories in order to not read somewhere that the person, the character that dies in book five, and then read book five or see the film and not have the emotional kick of that particular scene, which I think is fantastic. I mean, she protected that as best she could. That was one of the big changes we made in the Lexicon book. If we would have just taken the Lexicon website and turned it into a book, all is revealed. The Lexicon website is not as spoiler-filled as can be. Every character is described down to every last detail. Well, the changes that we made to the book were designed in part, were driven by the really desire of Rowling to not have all of this information given so that people can't enjoy the books and can't go to the book and kind of discover the story in the way that she wants them to. And so a lot of the changes we made were that. We took out all of the spoilers. And so when you read the Lexicon book, you'll see what I mean. And that's why I call it a quick reference. It's kind of your guide back into the books. If you want to find out more, you're going to go back to the actual books. But talking about visiting the set, one of the most memorable parts of, and how can I even say that, when every moment was memorable, but we were guided to a particular spot, and our person who was guiding us says, we really want you to experience this correctly. And we were taken to the little street, cobbled street, in front of the door of number 12 Grimmauld Place, which was there. I mean, the door, the snake lock knocker, the black door, the street, the railing on the square opposite, all of that was there. And then beyond that was a painting of the bushes and so that it looked like you were there. And what our guide wanted us to do was to experience walking into the set of number 12 Grimmauld Place from the street and just experience it correctly, if you will. And so we walked forward and we got to this black door of number 12, and this door opened, and I mean, you've seen this in the film, so you know, you can envision, but it's nothing like actually walking onto this set, walking into this hallway, this claustrophobic little hallway, walking down this dark, dingy, and you've got to realize that this set looked filthy. You'd swear that this thing was absolutely just covered in grime and grunginess. Walking down this hallway, seeing the troll leg umbrella stand, seeing the door ahead of us, which in the film you see it open and they're serious, but walking in here and then walking up this staircase. Now, jumping out of that, because I think I've talked about this before. Now, thinking about looking for the real, if you will, Grimmauld Place. Because as I was writing the book In Search of Harry Potter, one of the things I wanted to do was to find Grimmauld Place. And you might think, well, how are you going to find one particular square in all of London? London is not a small place. But as a matter of fact, if you look at the clues in the book, you can narrow it down pretty well, because they walk from Grimmauld Place to King's Cross in about 20 minutes with all of their stuff. So if you really want to find Grimmauld Place, all you need to do is get about a 20-minute walk, figure out about how many blocks that is, and then just draw a circle around King's Cross and Grim Old Place has to be somewhere inside that circle. Well, that's what we did, and tried to narrow it down and kind of put a circle of about a mile, radius out from Grim Old Place. Excuse me, from King's Cross, and then drew that circle, and then looked inside that circle to try to find a square that would fit the bill. Now, Camden is right inside that circle, and Camden certainly has the right look and feel to what's described in terms of, you know, kind of a little bit not quite upscale, maybe some broken windows, maybe some junk, and you know, maybe a little bit less fancy, which is the way Grim Old Place is described. And so I actually spent quite a bit of time wandering around in that area trying to find a place which would match. The trouble is there are no squares in that area, in Camden area. Camden's wonderful. I mean, it's an amazing place to wander around, really. If you want to go have some fun, you know, go to Camden and just go to the market and things like this. It's an amazing area. But there's no squares, okay? If you want to get squares, and you might think, well, you know, I actually lived quite near King's Cross, and there was a square right near where I lived, which almost matched the one in the film exactly. As a matter of fact, I think they filmed quite near where I live. But the problem with that square is that if in the books also, when Harry leaves in a Grim Old Place to go to, you know, with Mr. Weasley, they're going to go to the Ministry of Magic. And they go to a miserable little, and this is a quote, miserable little underground station. Well, if you are too close to King's Cross, you wouldn't go to a miserable little underground station. You'd go to King's Cross. And so you have to find a square which also the nearest underground station isn't King's Cross. Even though it's within, you know, a mile or so of King's Cross, there is one closer that you would go to which could be described as miserable. And so that narrowed it down a little bit into where to look. But then there's also the thing of you can't just go to any station because they had four stops to go to get to the center of London, you know, central London, where the ministry was. Well, again, if you count stops, that puts you a little ways away. King's Cross is not that far from, at least in underground terms, it's not that far from central London where the ministry would be. And so to get four stops away is actually takes you a, kind of on the opposite side, if you will, of King's Cross from central London. And so the area that we ended up looking, there were only about four or five squares there. And I actually walked around from one to the other looking for a square which could be considered to be Grim Old Place. Well, one thing I noticed is that, I'm sorry, places like this are not, you know, junky and broken windows and things like this. These kinds of places are pretty fancy because these houses are not cheap. I mean, we're talking, you know, $1 million-plus houses here. We're not talking about kind of messy, bad areas if you're talking about squares in this part of London. But, it's interesting because I walked from one to the other and they all look about the same and none of them have houses which are tall enough to really be Grim Old Place. They're all maybe three floors, maybe four, but Grim Old Place would be five. Now, you could say, well, yeah, it's magical, so, you know, you might not see the height, and that's true. But I ended up finding a square. It's called Lonsdale Square, and it actually has, it just looks totally different. I walked into this square, and it looked totally different than all the other ones in that area. This one, the houses were taller. Five floors, certainly, had kind of pointed roofline instead of the flat Georgian-style kind of standard square kind of looking thing. And interesting because number 12 had a black door, which was actually set back. I mean, this place looked like it could so much be Grim Old Place. It would have been great, of course, if there was no number 12. But on the other hand, I knew it was there, so I would be able to see it, right? Because even if you know it's there, then you can see it. That's the way the charm works, right? But one other thing then, of course, was the tricky thing was knowing which underground station was closest to Lonsdale Square. Because if it was a fancy underground station, I would still have a problem. Well, as it turns out, the closest underground station to Lonsdale Square is Highbury and Islington, which is definitely not an upscale station. I remember thinking it looked like somebody's garage, you know, just some sort of dingy squared off. Didn't even have the beautiful, you know, kind of arches that are the standard architecture for underground stations. So it was definitely what you would call it, a miserable little station. So I, you know, it's great fun when you wander around in London and you're looking for things like this and you find a place again which has that magic, has that sort of specialness to it, which makes you just think, I think I may have just walked that much closer to a magical place in London. Book 6. You know, we talked last time about the fact that book 5, the entire point of book 5, I call it the chrysalis book. It's the one where Harry has to change, or changes totally. He becomes this different type of hero. And we've been talking about this all along. Books 1 through 4, he becomes superhero Harry. And book 5, he goes through this transformation, very painful transformation, and we end up at book 6. Now, what is the point of book 6? The point of book 6 is, in some ways, to make book 7 make sense. Because if you didn't have book 6, you could not have the Harry of book 7. Book 7 is... okay, remember, Book 7 is totally, utterly different. Book 7 does not take place at Hogwarts. Book 7 is not Harry with all of his entourage around him. And I know the word entourage sounds totally wrong here, but he does not have Dumbledore. He does not have Hogwarts. He does not have even Snape as his enemy or friend or whatever. I mean, he doesn't have any of this. He doesn't have Slughorn. He doesn't have any of the people around him, the place around him, the familiarity around him to carry him through to the end. And where in book 5, he becomes this new superhero, and or not superhero, this new hero. Remember that, and Dumbledore tells him this, he has to become this person who love is the deep down motivating force, because that's what's going to defeat Voldemort. We don't have that yet at the end of book 5. We do have it at the beginning of book 7. Book 6 is that transition where he learns this new mode. He became this, he kind of is born at the end of book 5 in the ranting and raving in Dumbledore's office. He is in pain and suffering, he becomes this new person. And then here he is, this budding new baby, new hero, if you will, coming out of book 5. And then we have book 6. Now, let's look at book 6 and think about this. How do we see this change happen through the course of book 6? Some people think book 6 is kind of, I don't know if I'd use the word boring, but it doesn't have the action. It doesn't have the deep-seated conflict. But see, that's the point. It can't. It still has its conflicts. Oh my goodness, yes. He's got the conflict with Draco Malfoy going on through the whole thing. He's got the conflict with the book and with Hermione. And all of that. I mean, there's plenty of little conflict. But it's not the same as book 5, certainly. Or even book 4, where it's in a different mode. But let's look at it kind of step by step. First of all, before we go any further, think about the title of this book. It is not Harry Potter and Dumbledore. Even though it would seem that that's what most of the book is about, Harry Potter and Dumbledore, or Harry Potter and Voldemort, or Harry Potter and the Horcruxes. And it's because all of those things seem to be the point. Learning the background of Voldemort. Learning the background of this character who, and the background, of course, is part of what he needs to have to move forward. So that is part of his growing, part of his learning, part of his becoming this new hero is learning the background of Voldemort. But that's not the key to this story. Because if you look at the title, you will see that the key to this story, the key to this book, is, it's essentially the title is Harry Potter and Snape. Of course, we don't know it's Snape, it's the Half-Blood Prince, but that is the title of this book. And so you have to see the point of this book as being Harry's relationship with Snape. That is the point of this book, which is why it is so awfully sad that that whole connection, Snape as the Half-Blood Prince, Snape as being this person who has, in his own way, in his indirect way, been training Harry, we lose all of that in the film. It's just this sort of quick mention. The whole battle at the end is erased and replaced with a totally pointless and meaningless battle at the Burrow. Which, and side note here, I'm sorry, I've been to Devon. Devon doesn't look like that, at least not where the Burrow is, because I've been there. I've seen the actual Burrow. Okay, it doesn't look like that at all. It is not this flat swampland. I'm sorry. And what in the world are they thinking? Why can't they put the Burrow where the Burrow really is? What's the meaning or the reason to completely erase what's in canon and put this other location in there? Why? There's no need for it. If there was some good reason for it, I could see it. There are good reasons for a lot of things that they do in the films, but that was pointless. And then to take away all of the hidden away feeling. Because when you're there, when you find it, there's almost a claustrophobic feeling of being in this lost little corner of the world where people can't see you. You're hidden away. You're tucked away. You're within the hedgerows and within the trees. And why to put it in this flat plain with a swamp nearby? And then why to have a battle there, of all things? I know the reason why, I guess, in a sense. They wanted to show Harry and Ginny getting back together, closer together, which is part of what goes on in Book 6. It's part of the reason for Book 6. It's part of the important change that happens in Book 6. But, my goodness, it's one of those things that just makes you sad, okay? Because the battle at the end, not just the battle, not just the excitement, but the fact that Snape and Malfoy escape through the battle. You understand the importance of that moment where everyone lets him go because they think Dumbledore has said he's good, he's on our side, so the big battle going on, but they let him through even though he's just killed Dumbledore. Understand the importance of this, okay? Understand how it sets up the end of the book, the end of the series. Because Snape, his relationship with Harry, his relationship with the Wizarding World, his relationship with us at the end of Book 6 is the key. We have to go into Book 7 with this enormous wondering. We have to. That's what sets up all of this in Book 7, what takes us through Book 7, which takes us to, you know, the Princess Tale at the end of Book 7, when we finally get all these answers, okay? And it's just erased. It's not there. So let's go back to Book 6. I can go on and on about my disappointment about those things like this, but let's go to Book 6. Let's look. Remember, Book 6 starts with, like Book 5, And again, I know that Book 6 and Book 2 are the mirrors, but let's look at it in terms of Book 5. At the beginning of Book 5, the two worlds, the Muggle world and the Wizarding world, collide in this horrible, jarring, awful, violent way as Dementors swoop into Privet Drive and cause mayhem and problems. Okay, it happens again in Book 6, but in a different way, a more gentle, controlled, benign way. It's now Dumbledore coming into Privet Drive. And again, we have this Wizarding World crashing into the Dursleys, but in a totally different way. Not in the violent way of owls bumping into things and crashing into their living room, but Dumbledore gently reminding them of their job and the responsibility of being a caretaker of Harry and of their abuse, if you will, of Dudley. All of these things in this gentle way. That's at the beginning. Now let's keep that in mind. All of the things which were ripped away in Book 5 get replaced, not returned exactly, but replaced in Book 6 with new and better versions. his relationship with Dumbledore is returned, but in a totally different way. Think about the scene in the broom shed. Harry and Dumbledore, nose to nose in this tiny little space. Compare that to Harry and Dumbledore, nose to nose over the Pensieve in Book 5, when Harry's impulse is to strike and to hurt Dumbledore. And now here they stand together. Other things that are returned. His image of his father, which was destroyed in Book 5, is now replaced with this image of his mother that comes through Slughorn. He has private lessons again. Last time was with Snape, and were violent and horrible, and now there are these wonderful bonding times with his mentor. And think too, he doesn't go back to Grim Old Place, this dark, awful, dirty, grungy, negative place, but he goes to the Burrow, and he spends the end of his summer at the Burrow. Like Book 2, he arrives at Hogwarts in a very unusual way, and he's intercepted by Snape, and there's all these, you know, the bad things of that, but think about it again. Think about the difference in the Harry in Book 2 and the Harry now. And this is what you see happening all through this. Harry is now starting to be in charge of his own destiny. For example, good examples of this, Snape is now teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts. But do you notice when you read Book 6 how seldom we don't see the classes? I mean, you would think that we would see Snape, you know, abusing Harry like he did in Potions all the time. But no. The classes we watch are the ones with Slughorn. The one where Harry is successful, thanks to indirectly, behind the scenes, to Snape. We're seeing this totally different. So, I mean, he even writes an essay for Snape, it says, where he knows he's going to get a bad grade because he disagrees with Snape about how to tackle Dementors. So he writes his version, his idea of how to do it, in an essay. We never hear whether he actually did get a bad grade. But he has risen above. He is not in the total student mode with Snape. He is more in an equal mode. He's going to debate with Snape about the best way to tackle a Dementor. His relationship with Dumbledore, even when they disagree, and this happens several times, where he is frustrated because he's trying to tell Dumbledore about what's going on with Draco. See the mirroring here, because in the last one, he was this conduit for information about Voldemort, and he didn't try to talk about it. He didn't try to explain. He couldn't talk with Dumbledore. People were not listening to him, and he was trying to keep that information out of his mind. Now, he is trying to share information, and he's frustrated again. But this time, Dumbledore and he and Dumbledore have this kind of frustrating where they're each trying to get their point across, and Dumbledore kind of says, oh, this happens even among the best friends, where we each think what we want to say and which we our contribution is the most important. Do you see the equality in that kind of a discussion? Think about the fact that his whole relationship with the ministry becomes one of not even equality, but Harry is now in charge of that relationship. There's no more Umbridge, you know, controlling his life. Oh no, he now controls that relationship. Scrimgeour tries to talk to him, and that lovely scene in the garden when, you know, Scrimgeour is trying to get a hold of him, and at the same time he's watching a gnome trying to get a hold of a worm. You know, I mean, the lovely little moment. But Harry, no, he just will have none of it, and is in complete control of that relationship, even right down to the end. They offer him protection. They offer him Aurors, and Harry just says, "Now, don't be ridiculous." Well, he doesn't say that exactly, but he says, "You know, Voldemort wants to kill me, not the Aurors. You're just going to put your Aurors in jeopardy if you give them to me." And interesting, because Harry had wanted to be an Auror. Umbridge was going to stand in his way. Now he is going to be, or if he would have said yes, would have been in command of a couple of Aurors. So, I mean, it's just, again, that. And why is this connection between him and Voldemort broken? And the more and more I thought about it, as I was reading the book and I'm thinking about the dreams in particular, what is he dreaming about all the time? He has disquieting dreams, but they're not focused. But what does he end up dreaming about and daydreaming about? Ginny. And what is the one thing Voldemort cannot handle is love. As he falls in love with Ginny and he becomes aware of this and that monster inside of him, it isn't Voldemort. The monster inside of him is love. You see that new Harry coming in here. Love is controlling him now. And then at the end, of course, in this fabulous and horrible scene, which is actually Book 7, Part 1, the cave sequence, and Harry can go along with Dumbledore because he's earned that right. That's what Dumbledore tells him. You see, at that point, he has now achieved, he has now become this new hero. Sadly, the one thing that's missing is, and fans all knew this, which is kind of, in a sense, it was a little bit funny because Rowling was very cagey about, you know, what was going to be happening in Book 6, obviously. Because Book 6, again, look at the storytelling. She had now shifted completely and fully into answering questions mode. She had to. It was getting to the end. She had to answer all these, or not all, but many of these questions she'd been raising for the last 5 books. Well, it was time to start answering these questions. And so she was starting to put the answers in place with all of the wonderful stories of Voldemort's past and all of the discovery of the whole idea of Horcruxes. And now we have defined what it is that Harry needs to do. And how by the end, he is seeing this path ahead of him that he needs to walk. We are being set up now for Book 7. And the reason I say the cave sequence is the first episode of Book 7 is because Book 7 is a totally different book. It is essentially a series of set pieces, each of which is the destruction of a Horcrux. That's what Book 7 is. And it's all interconnected with what we fans at the time called the Camping Trip from Hell. But that's what Book 7 is. Well, Book 6 ends with the first of those set pieces. And of course, in the film, understandably, I guess, that was the climax of the film. And that and Dumbledore's death, even though that's not really the climax of the book. The climax of the book is Harry's and Snape's, you know, duel on the Hogwarts grounds, and that's after Dumbledore's death, after the Battle of the Tower. That is the main climax of the book, which, of course, is just quickly swept aside in the film. But as we get up to this, Harry has changed in the way he looks at things. And we see this mostly in his own musings at the end of Book 6, as we kind of are getting ourselves set up to get into Book 7. And he says, he thinks what Dumbledore was trying to tell him about, and this is before the final guts of it, when he the final cave sequence, when he discovers the difference in this long conversation with Dumbledore between the old hero version of himself and the new hero. The old version, which is he describes in his mind as being dragged into the arena to face a battle to the death, and the new hero, which is walking into the arena with your head held high, which of course is what he does at the end. He walks into that last confrontation with Voldemort with his head held high. And so we see that coming there. Also, and this is actually a lot more important, I think, than a lot of people realize, just how important it is in how he deals with the death of Dumbledore. He says, and this is actually this is from the book, he still found it difficult to believe that Dumbledore had really gone. Admittedly, he had not, as he had with Sirius, looked desperately for some kind of loophole, some way that Dumbledore would come back. You see, that's the difference. With Sirius, he was desperately trying to find some way to bring Sirius back, some way to, because he felt this guilt of having caused it, of having his old self was what caused Sirius's death. His new self accepts death accepts the fact that he has a part in events which result in death. He knows that the things that he has to do might involve people dying. Look at what he does when he gives his orders before he leaves with Dumbledore for people to guard, to keep an eye on, for the DA to go into harm's way. He orders his friends. He even wonders if he has just ordered his friends to their deaths. And he does it because he knows that's what he has to do. He does not... His view of death has changed. And part of it is with the death of Sirius. Part of it is with the death of Dumbledore, which, frankly, we all knew was going to happen. As somebody kind of jokingly said, the old guy with the beard always dies. And the mentor had to get out of the way because Harry now has to be by himself. And it's this passage from the end of the book where he says, Harry saw very clearly as he sat there under the hot sun how people who cared about him had stood in front of him one by one, his mother, his father, his godfather, and finally Dumbledore, all determined to protect him. But now that was over. He could not let anybody else stand between him and Voldemort. He must abandon forever the illusion he ought to have lost at the age of one, that the shelter of a parent's arms meant that nothing could hurt him. There was no waking from his nightmare, no comforting whisper in the dark that he was safe, really, that it was all in his imagination. The last and greatest of his protectors had died, and he was more alone than he had ever been before. But you see, that aloneness, think about the whole passage, think about the way that that aloneness informs who Harry is. And now, of course, Harry in charge, Harry with his mission clear in front of him, and not perfectly clear, but in front of him, ready to move forward. He knows that that Ron and Hermione are going to go with him. And so he is not alone in the sense of no support, but alone in terms of he's breaks things off with Ginny, but in a way that they both know doesn't really end their feelings. It just ends the physical part of the relationship for now. He looks forward with determination. He rejects the ministry and the protections of the ministry. He rejects all of these things around him. He looks forward, but then notice what he says. He is so in command. He says, I'm going back to the Dursleys. So he chooses to go back. He is so different than the Harry at the end of book one, or book two even, or book three. This Harry, this new Harry, is deliberately taking steps, good steps, bad steps, good as in that he'll enjoy or that he won't enjoy or that he needs to do or doesn't need to do. He's going to take each one of those steps. In some ways, that going back to the Dursleys is the first hard step on that path that he needs to go down. And remember what we learned in book 7. All of book 6, he has been trying to tell other people what he knew about what Draco was up to, what was going on, and people would not listen to him. People tried to pass it off. Remember at Christmas when he was there in the Burrow and he tried to explain to Mr. Weasley, he tried to explain to Lupin, and they always have excuses and reasons why what he is talking about, he's just interpret things in certain ways. Okay, now go to at the end of the Battle of the Seven Potters. What is the thing that they say that Dumbledore told the members of the Order of the Phoenix is to trust Harry? So that is gone. They're going to listen to him. They're going to believe him. He has now become the leader of whatever movement, whatever group, whatever defense there is against Voldemort. Harry has now become that hero. So then we go into book 7. We don't go back to Hogwarts because Hogwarts is not part of it. Now it is. You know perfectly well. I know perfectly well. We all know perfectly well that wonderful things happened at Hogwarts. Horrible things, but wonderful things. We all want to know the story. We'll get to that at some point. Hopefully someday, Rowling will take it upon herself to tell us the story of all the things or give us clues of what happened at Hogwarts in that seventh year. But Be that as it may, we are now coming up to book 7. Harry is ready. Harry is that the hero that he needs to be. And so we're looking at book 7 is the next book that we're going to talk about. One last thing we do need to mention, and this is so critically important, is that we have to see what happens at the end of the chapter 26, because this is the crucial statement, if you will, in this book. This is after the cave incidents. Dumbledore is on the edge of death, we know, both from the potion and then also what's going to happen on the tower in a moment. Harry says, and I'm just going to read a little bit. It says, this Dumbledore says, "I am weak," he said. "Don't worry, sir," said Harry at once, anxious about Dumbledore's extreme pallor and his air of exhaustion. "Don't worry, I'll get us back. Lean on me, sir." Now notice, who's taken over? Before, Harry said, "I know how to operate, but I'm not sure I can do it," and so he leans on Dumbledore. Dumbledore takes him to this situation. Now, he goes all the way down to the end, where this time, Dumbledore wants to put his blood on that doorway, and Harry says, "No need, I got cut on the rock," and he puts his blood there. And then they're going through the icy water. Harry says, "It's going to be all right, sir," Harry said over and over again, more worried by Dumbledore's silence than he had been by his weakened voice. "We're nearly there. I can apparate us both back. Don't worry." "I'm not worried, Harry," said Dumbledore, his voice a little stronger despite the freezing water. "I am with you." And that right there is that moment. This is that moment where Harry is now become the person he needs to be. Dumbledore passes that mantle, to use the cliche. Harry is now the one that Voldemort must most fear. Harry is now taken over from Dumbledore. Dumbledore is about to step aside in every way that you can think. He is about to have his last moment and be gone. And now we are going to see Harry become that solitary but part of this trio of heroes, but the leader and in some ways the one that it all comes down to, the one that it's most seriously involves. He is going to lead the way, lead us out of book 6. This newly reborn, newly recreated hero is going to lead us into book 7. And of course, book 7 becomes this series of set pieces leading us, of course, to the Battle of Hogwarts. We will pick up next time around with book 7, and we'll talk about that book, go into a little bit more detail, look at some more of the bits and pieces, but also just look at the way that the saga ends. And remembering, of course, always that Rowling had this all in hand, that she had this whole saga planned. We saw that in that quote about Rita Skeeter. She knew what was going to be happening. She knew all along that there were Horcruxes, all along that there were Deathly Hallows, and all along that we were going to be putting this all together in the most critical chapter of Book 7, and we'll find out what chapter that is when we talk about that next time. We are also going to talk about a character next time. We're going to be talking about the character of Ferenczi. Ferenczi is a fascinating character. You remember that I put a poll on the Facebook page asking who the most intriguing non-wizard character was, and Ferenczi won by far, which surprised me because I just did not expect that. But we're going to talk a little bit more about Ferenczi next time. We're going to talk about his relationship with Harry. He appears briefly at the end of Book 6 and is not really back in the series, but we'll talk about that next time a little bit when we talk about some of the characterizations and things. A couple things to talk about before we sign off for this one. Again, if you're listening to this way in the future, this isn't going to matter so much, but the July 1, 2012 Alohomora podcast, which is a MuggleNet podcast where we talk about canon and things. I say we because I was a guest host on there, which was a wonderful experience, a great honor to be part of that podcast. And that one became went live on July 1, became available for you to listen to. So love to have you listen to that. One of the things that we're going to start talking about next time is something which came up there in that podcast. And we're going to talk about that quite a bit more next time, and also probably in Book 4 of the Reader's Guide series. And that's something which I call Convergence. Also, tomorrow, and again, this is July 7, 2012, so tomorrow is July 8, I'm going to be hosting a Hangout on Google Plus at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. A Hangout is kind of a video chat when we can all get together and talk about Harry Potter. Last Sunday night, we talked about what we call the essential Harry Potter. We talked about the first five books and some of the key chapters. We talked the first four books, I believe. We talked about some of the key chapters. If you're going to go back and just read certain chapters to kind of really kind of re-immerse yourself in Harry Potter, kind of remind yourself about important plot points, also just kind of remind yourself about Rowling's amazing writing. And some of them we talked about were things like Chamber of Secrets Chapter 3, which is when he first goes to the Burrow. And just the delight of that as he discovers this wizarding dwelling. And what a delight it was for us as readers to kind of expand our vision outside of the Muggle world of Privet Drive and Hogwarts, and then to have this whole new, rich, delightful place, which is the Burrow. So we talked about that, and I'm working actually on a lexicon page to go along with that, which is kind of everybody's recommendations and thoughts about certain chapters, and that page is going to be coming up live soon. So if you are listening to this before July 8 at 9 p.m. 2012, by all means, wander over to Google Plus at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time and join the Hangout. We're going to be broadcasting it live, so you can watch it even if you aren't going to be joining it. As always, if you want to get a hold of me, you can email me at steve.lexicon@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, which is lexicon_Steve. There's a Facebook fan page, which we post a lot of things there, and also on Google Plus fan page. The links for those are included on the show notes, which you can find on the Harry Potter Lexicon website, which is at www.hp-lexicon.org, and you can click on the podcast link and you can find notes about this podcast. You can find links to things like the Kindle versions of the lexicon and of the reader's guide. You can find links to the Facebook and Google Plus fan pages and things like that. All of that is there. So I hope you take a look at that. Thanks again to Harry and the Potters, because they are the ones who allowed me to use the music that I have at the beginning, at the end of the podcast, and also a shout out to Lisa Bunker and AccuQuote, which is where I got all this information, get all these old interviews and things, which are linked there. Wonderful resource. If you haven't checked that out, you really need to. But that about wraps up episode 13. I'll be back for episode 14 when we'll be talking about book 7. But for now, this is Steve Vandererk of the Harry Potter Lexicon, and thanks for listening.